Hello and welcome to episode
116
of the Tech Reformation, where the world of technology meets the worldview of Christianity. I'm Ben.
And this is Craig.
This week, has technology changed love? And should you baptize your babies or not?
Grab your USBs and ESVs and let's get started. I want to talk about a video I came across on YouTube. It's a TEDx video, I think, and the speaker is someone called Helen Fisher. She's an anthropologist, human behavior researcher, and self-help author, which might give some people some ideas about where she's coming from already. But if that wasn't enough, she's also the senior scientific advisor at Match.com, which was news to me because I didn't know there was much scientific about things like Match.com. But apparently, they do employ scientists, at least in some capacity. She's been that for a number of years, I think over a decade. And she sort of starts off talking about the prominence of love in the human experience throughout all of time, or all of recorded history. And right from the outset, I got to say, it's pretty clear that she's got some really obvious presuppositions about things. So she talks a bit about, you know, millions of years and hundreds of thousands of years, where she's getting her intel from in terms of what happened that far back. I'm not aware, but she obviously thinks she has some sources to go on. And she talks at one point about Darwinian, and there must be a Darwinian explanation for this. So she's clearly coming from that sort of side of the equation.
I missed that part.
But it's all the way. It's just kind of spreaded through. She sort of has these comments every now and then that kind of...
No, I caught that. I caught the first thing you said. I didn't catch the specific reference to Darwin.
Yeah, she did reference that. And I can't remember what it was in relation to. And then, so she's basically saying she doesn't think that technology has actually changed love, and she doesn't think that it will, basically. So that's her premise, is that technology has changed a lot of things, or has lots of impacts on the way that we live. But in terms of the actual concept of love and the way we, our experience of it as a human emotion, a human interaction, and I guess one of the foundations of our existence, that actual thing called love has not been changed by technology. So I guess when we're talking about this, it may be helpful to every time you hear technology has changed or hasn't changed, think in terms of our interactions with technology have changed or haven't changed, because otherwise we might end up in the quagmire of tech neutrality nuances.
And what a quagmire it is.
Which could just take up another whole episode. But yeah, she makes some interesting points early on. She says, 86% of human societies permit a man to have several wives, but only 5% do, 5 to 10% do.
To be totally fair on the quagmire, Derek has essentially ceded all ground to me in this argument because he's shifting. His argument's changing. Yeah. He's not arguing what he used to argue anymore.
No, he's just now, you know, precursoring it with, you might put some different, you know, a different spin on it than I would. Like, he sort of tries to make it sound like there's still a bit of a difference, but it's not as big of a chasm as it was before.
Yeah, well, when you saw off the legs of the wooden stool someone is sitting on, they are desperate to not fall to the ground flat.
Nice. Yep. Okay. Well, I'm happy to leave that there. But yeah, I've always been on the same, I think the same wavelength as you in that discussion. So, but I just think for simplicity, let's go with it. We're talking about our interactions with technology haven't actually changed the concept or the thing that is love. So she makes a few sort of early points about 86% of societies essentially allow polygamy, but even within those cultures, only a small percentage of those people, relatively small, engage in that. So we are by default a pair bonding species. She also said that 97% of mammals don't pair up to rear their young, but humans do. So she comes back to the idea that we're sort of built to love. It's just part of who we are and the way that we're wired. And she talks about the way that technology has, I guess, certainly changed the way that we get to know people and the way that we date. And so there have been some, I guess, yeah, certain things that have changed that. So online dating, even, you know, cars, and she called them rolling bedrooms in the 1940s, and things like that. But she said, like, the only real algorithm that exists is the human brain in terms of how love actually develops. In terms of technology specifically, like the type that we'd be talking about, she does talk about the fact that it's introduced like a paradox of choice, which we see in the internet, social media, the app store, pretty much everywhere you look online. Whereas, you know, there used to be smaller communities, villages, groups that lived together and you'd kind of find someone in that group to marry. Now we have this huge amount of choice and places like Match.com are just adding to that, I would say. But she talks about, you know, we can only really have 5 to 9 viable alternatives in our brain before cognitive overload happens. So when it comes to finding a partner, someone to really invest in, it's not surprising that we find that difficult and or people are finding that difficult in the culture that we live in. And then another lady comes on afterwards for a Q&A and sort of says the same thing. And she reckons that FOMO comes into love as well because of the way that we interact online. So people are sort of worried about not finding the right one and all this kind of thing, you know, missing out on the right one or missing out on love altogether. So I guess the question I have for you, as well as just hearing your thoughts on the topic in general, is technology changing? Well, firstly, is it changing love? I actually think I agree with her. It's not changing love. And we can talk about why that is. But then the follow-on question to that is technology changing our capacity to love? So not love itself, but our capacity to interact with someone in a loving way, particularly like deep love, like a marriage relationship.
Yeah, good questions, I think, in light of the video, which, by the way, we have linked in the show notes so you can see the TED Talk yourself if you like. Craig's just done a great job summarizing the essence of the talk and the main points in general. So you don't need to go watch it to understand the conversation, but you certainly can if you want some more context. I'll start by saying, I thought it was interesting that the unstoppable human brain has evolved over thousands, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, millions, however many years she thinks it's evolved. Mm-hmm. And it's gone through that much change, and yet it hasn't fundamentally changed in its need for love, even through all kinds of different societies. You'd think that that would be something evolution would, you know, change, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, you would. I guess you would assume so, yep. Unless, I guess, the argument is, and I think she makes the case that the reason that love maybe has continued throughout evolutionary cycles is because it all stems from, she calls it this, the most primitive part of the brain beneath the cortex, which is the desire to find a mating partner, which I guess is necessary in an evolutionary worldview to perpetuate your own family line or whatever.
Yeah, there were a lot of references to the primordial urge to love and the ancient brains that we have descended from our ancient ancestors from millions of years ago or whatever. And it's just interesting that one of the most fundamental aspects of what it means to be human hasn't changed an iota yeah. in all this time of evolutionary process. It's interesting. Anyway, I also thought that the follow-along Q&A at the end with the other gal, whose name I don't remember, I think it was Esther or something like that.
Perel, I think. Esther Perel.
Yeah, thank you. That was helpful in the sense of clarifying what it was the speaker meant. So she was saying our basic desire for love hasn't changed.
Yeah.
And then Esther came along and said, now the context in which we love has changed. And so maybe your second question about capacity seems to have shifted somewhat. What I thought was really interesting, and I'll toss it back to you after this. Mm. What I thought was really interesting was, it seemed like all of the things she mentioned as changing the way we love at the end of the video were more cultural, more artifacts of culture. So the big shift in maybe what we would call the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, the move from collectivist society to individualistic society is the most fundamental thing that has changed the way we love.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't disagree with that point. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. I think that's helpful. In fact, I think, you know, our Western minds are so plagued by individualism. It's just the way we look at the world. We don't even realize we're wearing rose-colored glasses, but we are.
Mm.
That it even affects how we read our Bibles. and how we look at the church. And I had to read a really, really excellent book on this particular topic a few months ago for class at Southern. I took a class called Discipleship and Family Ministry. And the book is called When the Church Was a Family by Joseph Hellerman. Really, really good. And I would recommend, I wish every Western Christian could read it. Even just like the first six chapters, maybe, or the first like chunk of the book. You don't have to read the whole thing. And I wouldn't, you know, unquestionably affirm everything that the guy says, but his delineating between the two cultural mindsets, the group culture and the individual culture, is so good. Mm. And, you know, 2000 years ago, when the letters of the New Testament and the Gospels of the New Testament, when all of that was written, they were in a group based society, a collectivist society. And so the metaphors they use, the analogies they use, the shared culture they have is not individualistic, even though that's how we try to read it 2000 years later. And so I was really appreciated that point being made in the video as well, because it was really helpful for me when I read the book. So just a shout out on that.
Mm. Yeah, that sounds like an interesting read. We should put that in the show notes as well. Sure. I think, yeah, I agree. I agree with her, with that point that was made at the end. And that was, I guess that was one of the, that was something else that I wanted to sort of circle back around to, just to expand a little bit on what I mean by changing our capacity to love before we go, fully onto that point. I guess the reason that terminology or that way of looking at it came up was I was just thinking of along the lines of again, so focused on how we allow ourselves to interact with technology. But, you know, if you look at the distraction that it presents, the level of choice, the grass is greener, online social media, you know, everyone else's life is perfect, including their love life. And the fact that there's just more, I guess the internet is so good for us in terms of giving us a way of connecting with people that would be so difficult to do so otherwise, like this. It'd be sucky if we had to do this podcast via snail mail. but also it enables us to have more relationships, but it inevitably seems, because of the number of those relationships that are now possible, there seems to be a shallower base level of those relationships, mm-hmm. which is still not technology's fault. We could all be a lot more intentional about having deeper relationships, even the ones that are only online because of distance or whatever. We could be more intentional about that, but it seems like we're so wanting to have our finger slightly on the pulse of so many people's lives and kind of, you know, being a little bit in contact with so many people that we may lose the capacity to deeply invest in the few people that we need to, or is particularly for people who are sort of trying to find someone to marry, like a life partner, someone that that they can create a Christian family with. I think that might be a hindrance that has changed our capacity to engage in love rather than actually the fact that we want to love and need to love itself. And I guess we would both agree that underlying point of the desire for love comes not from some special part of our brain, but because of the fact that we're made in the image of God, and his, one of his attributes is love, and that he defines love and he's the source of love. So we obviously have a different understanding of that to what it seems like this lady has, Helen Fisher has. But to your other point on, you know, the sort of shift in societal focus, I guess, from sort of what's for the collective good of society and what's going to benefit my family, my children, and, you know, what are the things that are going to be good for those, that sort of group mentality, to individualistic, self-seeking, me first kind of, and actually, to be perfectly honest, anti-complementarian, like our society is basically idolizes egalitarianism. And we would affirm that all people are equal in God's sight, and they should be equal in our sight as well. But we also affirm that he's created men and women differently, and that's a beautiful thing. So in a society that does think that way, and where the internet kind of perpetuates that with sort of the focus on feminism and all that stuff that surrounds, you know, so much of what goes on online. How do we point the world? I'm still sort of trying to figure out my own answer to this, but how should we point the world to God's design for love and marriage? And is modeling it imperfectly enough? So as Christians who are trying to follow a biblical understanding of marriage and point, you know, point our families and point people to Jesus and his relationship with the church through our marriages, is doing that, is modeling that in the imperfect way that we are able to enough, or is there anything else we can be doing to kind of point people in that direction, I guess?
I guess in one sense it has to be, because we can't model it perfectly.
Correct.
And I guess in one more important and more foundational sense, it could never be enough, because in the same way that you can't argue someone into the kingdom, you can't love someone into the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't. The only way you get into the kingdom is, and there's one way, it's spiritual rebirth. It's hearing the gospel of Christ, repenting of your old way of life, and following him in a new way of life. It's a work of the Spirit of God that brings people from the domain of darkness into the kingdom of his beloved Son. And so God, in his kindness, has chosen to operate under or in and through, I should say, certain means, and love, both love and argument, are often used by God in his work to bring sinners to himself. But yeah, not only can we not do it, it's fundamentally, it's not possible. It's a work that the Spirit of God has to do.
Mm, yeah.
And so, we certainly do the best we can because we're called to, and more importantly, because we love the one who has saved us.
Yeah.
It's in response to what he's done that we reach out to others and share the gospel and, even just love our neighbor.
Yep. I agree. And I think, yeah, that's really good. And I think that it's hard to sort of project this kind of thing into the future, but I'm imagining that as our culture continues on its current path, in the same way that so many of the stories that people love involve themes of self-sacrifice and things like that, that I would find it hard to imagine that it wouldn't be the case that over time people would not realize that that kind of, that the Christian view of love and marriage of putting the other first, and be, you know, in the husband's case, being willing to die for the wife, and those kinds of things, are actually more attractive, more, you know, more fulfilling, more ultimately good for us as humans than the self-seeking, self-pleasure-driven model that is currently being pursued. So I think, yeah, I think you're right. We will never do it perfectly because none of us are perfect, but we do have a perfect model to follow in terms of Christ and his bride, the church. And so I suppose the best
thing, the good news is that though none of us are perfect, there was and is one man who is.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's Jesus.
Yes. So yeah, that's basically all I had to bring up on that. I just thought it was an interesting video. Like I said, there was some things that the lady said that we actually agreed with, but we just come from completely opposite worldviews, I suppose, in terms of what feeds that. And there's some other things I disagree with as to what she said. But yeah, I think that's a helpful discussion to have and things to keep in mind.
Hey, this is Derek. Just jumping in here real quick to tell you about our sponsor this week, which is Missionalware, your Reformed theology gift shop. Missionalware designs fun and useful things to broadcast your faith for the world to see, and you can check everything out there at missionalware.com. The designs are really beautiful, with creeds, quotes, and faces of various reformers available for printing across a variety of items, including, and this is breaking news, beep, 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 beep. I believe Missionalware usually goes to Ligonier National Conference, and that is true this year. And they debuted a new John Calvin tie to buy at LigCon, and you can buy that now online, but there is a limited number of them to get. So if that's something that you're interested in, you should probably hit them up here soon. Missionalware has been providing you with quality Reformed apparel and accessories for over 6 years, and they've grown an impressive library of designs and items that will appeal to any theologian. So Whether you're into neckties or not, you should go check them out. You can do that at missionalwear.com to get your lifestyle on mission to the glory of God. Thanks to them for sponsoring Tech Reformation this week.
Well, Craig, I've been thinking about it, and I've finally found the answer.
Okay. This is one of those things. This is one of those things where we settle an age-old debate on Tech Reformation, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a little bit of time—not a whole lot, but just a little bit of time—thinking about it, and you know, I'm not super old, but I spent a little bit of time thinking about this, and I've decided that people should not baptize their babies.
I agree.
Well, all right. So, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Yes, I'm super glad you brought this up because I've been wanting to talk about this for quite a while. And there's a lot going around in podcast land about this at the moment. Or there always is, I guess. It's kind of bubbling below the surface. But what has made you bring it up and where are you coming from on this? I'm interested to hear what you're thinking.
Yeah, so I've had some really good conversations with in the Slack with folks who listen to our podcast about this topic and have been having those for the past month or so. And then I don't remember exactly when, but a couple of weeks ago, the Reform Pubcast, you know, Les and Tanner, our friends over at the Reform Pubcast, put out an episode where someone called in and asked for their best arguments for why we should baptize babies. And I listened to it. And I was actually excited because I love the chance to understand the argument a little bit better,
yeah,
even if I still end up disagreeing. But I just got to the end of it and I was just really, really dissatisfied.
Yeah.
I don't follow the logic and I wish other people didn't either.
I agree. I remember listening to that episode and I think I tweeted not long after that. I said to someone, or maybe it was just before, it came up on Twitter. And I said, I basically find it hard to listen to that particular podcast these days because of the fact that they sort of seem to talk about it, sort of dance around it and then talk about it semi-regularly. And just the arguments that have been presented, I always find to be less, a lot less satisfying than the hosts seem to find them. And yet it's presented as kind of like, it's so obvious. Why can't people see this thing? Like, and they try and do it with grace and humility.
You saying they're in the paedo-baptist cage stage? Is that what you're saying?
A little. Maybe not. Maybe they would argue that they're not. And I think they try and use grace and, you know, they used to be Baptists. And so they understand where Baptists are coming from and all that kind of thing. But I guess the tendency, not just with that podcast, but just in general in this discussion is that, I guess there is kind of an underlying tone of, you're more reformed if you're a paedo-baptist than if you're a credo-baptist and that kind of thing, which is not a good discussion to get into and we won't really go there, but it's that thing of like...
On my top 10 list of the least interesting conversations I ever want to have, what the word reformed means is somewhere in the top 5 for sure.
Okay, so we definitely won't go there. But you know what I mean, don't you? Like, it's just... The idea with, and it's probably the same with any viewpoint, is if you're holding to that viewpoint, you're holding to it because you think it's right. And so therefore you think the other ones are wrong. And so that you kind of just have a bias that always comes through in what you say. And that's understandable. But when that bias seems to be like, so from my perspective, their bias is misplaced and the arguments that have been given to support it are also, not very strong, then it kind of makes me not necessarily want to continue listening to those arguments. But I'm also in the same camp as you in that I want to know what the best argument is. I want to know what the best other position is so that I can make sure that I'm interacting with things accurately. So what would be helpful is, can you articulate, because I did listen to the episode, but some people wouldn't have. Can you articulate what sort of the main crux of the thread of discussion was? What is the main argument?
Yeah, I'll try. And I don't expect to do it perfectly. Let me first say, to Les and Tanner's credit, and I really, really appreciate those guys. I don't know them personally.
Yeah, they
but
seem like great guys.
I remember listening to the Reformed Pubcast, just a couple episodes after it first started. And it has been such a huge blessing and a gift of God in my own spiritual walk in my own growth in Christ. So I appreciate what they're doing. I'm very thankful for them. I really particularly appreciate the opportunity to not be misrepresented. So they were Reformed Baptists. And so they are not quick to, and I don't know that I've ever heard them just blatantly misrepresent or straw man or anything like that, which is awesome.
That's good.
And very refreshing in this particular conversation. So to their credit, I mean, props on that. That's fantastic.
And when I made that comment on Twitter, Les actually, or one of them, I think it was Les, but one of them actually responded and said, sort of like chew up the meat, spit out the bones. Like if there's stuff you disagree with, then we hope you can still enjoy the rest of the episodes, which was actually convicting for me because I had to go, well, I kind of have actually just stopped listening and I should not be that sort of hasty to, you know, to do that because, yeah, same thing for me. It has been a blessing. And so it's actually, we are grateful for what they're doing. It's not, it's just that there's this one area that we disagree on and sometimes it's a little frustrating.
Yeah. And I'll also say, I don't know if I've ever said this publicly, but the Reformed Pubcast is the reason that this podcast is even a thing.
Yeah.
So we owe them a great deal of gratitude.
True. So with all that said, as a disclaimer, what was the main thread of their discussion?
Yeah. I'll try to summarize what I think I've heard as two main thrusts of the argument. Okay. And then I'd love to hear you respond to them.
Yeah.
So the first is, if you're familiar with this sort of Orthodox Presbyterian Church Oikobaptist position, I hear a lot of that. I don't know if they'd say that they're Oikobaptists. They certainly say that they're Paedobaptists, but I hear a lot of this when they talk. And the idea is that when you have children of believing parents, so Mr. and Mrs. Christian have some babies, and I've even seen Les refer to the whole household as the Christians. And so you have your child baptized, the child of Mr. and Mrs. Christian is baptized so that the whole household is dedicated or consecrated to the Lord. And so they might talk about verses like 1 Corinthians 7, where it talks about the unbelieving spouse being set apart or made holy or whatever your text renders it as, your English text. And that's where they get some of that idea from. Also, there's lots of examples typically given in Acts of household baptisms. So the Philippian jailer and Lydia, and there are others that people go to, but I think those are usually the two most common. So that's one. And kind of along with that,
most Paedobaptists would agree that the household baptisms line would not be their strongest foot to put forward in this discussion, right? Because there's no,
sure,
as they admitted, I think, on the show, there's no explicit mention of infants in those households. Those households could have only had teenagers or whatever in them. We don't know.
Oh, you're talking about the household baptisms and
household baptism,
household baptisms.
Sorry, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so following along from that argument, and I don't know that this is specifically an Oikobaptist argument. I hear Les talking about Bavinck saying it, and I trust him on that because I haven't read Bavinck, so okay, great. But I guess the idea is that whenever you are saved, you give over everything that you possess to the Lord. What you have, since you have become the Lord's, everything you have becomes the Lord's. And so there's this idea of, similarly to what I was saying before, there's this idea of consecrating even your children because, they're your children. Well, now they're God's children in not in the theological sense of adoption, but in the sense of they're set apart in some special and unique way as covenant children. And so there were obviously other minor points being made about the nature of the new covenant as mixed, and that it is, there's a lot of continuity in the new covenant and the older covenants. So the covenant with Abraham and the covenant with Sinai and the covenant with David, and how all of those covenants in the Old Testament are mixed. There are believers and unbelievers in them, and so therefore the new covenant we would expect to be mixed, and so there are believers and unbelievers in it, and the idea is that covenant children who grow up and perhaps renounce the faith, God forbid, are the sort of mixed body of unbelievers in the new covenant community. How do you think I did, Craig?
I think as a summary, I think that's pretty good, pretty helpful. And I think that's basically what I recall as well. I will say that I don't remember having come across the as like a key argument, the idea that when you become a Christian, everything that's yours becomes, like, you realize that it's actually God's, and so you consecrate it to Him. Like, that I'm sure I probably have heard that before, but when they sort of said that, I was like, okay, that's an interesting angle that I don't always take into consideration when I'm thinking about this issue. But yeah, it's still, I think those were the key points that I remember them making as well.
I'll also mention here that we may very well have misunderstood, and we certainly do not want to misrepresent. We appreciate the opportunity to not be misrepresented, and we want to extend the same to our brothers, Les and Tanner. So if they want to come on the show and correct us on anything I've said, I'm happy to have that conversation.
Mm. Albeit not necessarily about technology. And so, yeah, okay. So with that as our summary to work from, I think something that I think Tanner may have said during the episode was when I think it was when they were talking, because it was a caller who'd left them a voicemail and asked the question, you know, what's the best case for infant baptism? My husband and I are trying to work out whether or not we should head in that direction or whatever. And I think Tanner made the point of saying, you just need to do some reading, do some solid study on covenant theology. Like that was his, like he sort of brought it back to that towards the end of what they were saying. And sort of said, if you understand this, then that will probably go a long way to helping you understand the case for infant baptism. And I guess my personal, the thing that I really struggle with, and I sort of just haven't, maybe I haven't come across the right counterpoint yet, but I keep coming back. So I don't want to discount that. I don't want to say covenants aren't really important or anything like that. What I want to say is, okay, let's talk about the covenants, but let's focus on the new covenant because that's the one we're living under as believers in this side of the New Testament. And so what does the new covenant actually say in Jeremiah 31? And what does it mean for us today? And how do we apply it? And so when you're looking right at the start of, you know, Jeremiah, when he's actually saying this is the covenant in Jeremiah 31:33, for this is a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord, I will put my law within them and I'll write it on their hearts and I will be their God and they shall be my people. And no longer shall each one teach his neighbor and each his brother saying, know the Lord, for they shall all know me from the least to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I'll forgive their iniquity and I'll remember their sin no more. So when he says all there, I'm not a universalist, so I have to take that in light of all true believers, like all, you know, all, and you can correct me at any point if you think I'm going down a wrong path. But the thing that I keep coming back to is he will put the law within us and write it on our hearts. So that's God doing that. God will write it on our hearts. And that is not something that I think Christian parents can do. Christian parents can train their children in the way of the Lord. They can teach, and we should teach our children about God, about who he is, about what he's done for us, about how we should live in response to him. We can try and answer their questions. We can guide them. We can take them to church to worship with the body of believers. We can do all these things, but we can't write the law on their hearts. That is something that only God can do. And I would say that is something that God does for his people. Unregenerate people don't have the law of God written on their hearts, I don't believe. And so I think if that's the sort of covenant that we're talking about, then why would the covenant sign from the old, like one of the old covenants, which is the outward covenant sign in the Old Testament was circumcision, and the argument is often made that the outward covenant sign in the New Testament for those who are part of the covenant community is baptism. Why would we give the outward covenant sign in the New Testament under the New Covenant to people who may or may not have the law written on their hearts by God? And I don't think anyone's saying that baptism, you know, in traditional Paedo-Baptist, discounting, you know, Lutheran baptismal regeneration or whatever, I don't think these guys are saying that baptism regenerates children. They're saying it's a covenant sign as members of, makes them members of the covenant community. But I would say there's a lot of talk in the New Testament about the fact that Jesus fulfills so much of the Old Testament. You know, he's the true and better David. He's the true, you know, he's the prophet, priest, and king that we've been waiting for throughout the Old Testament. It's all pointing to him. And so I actually think there's a really strong argument that there would be some real differences between how the old covenant is administered and who the signs are given to, and the new covenant and how that's administered and who the signs are given to. So I think the whole thing of, you know, not all Israel is true Israel, that's significant when it comes to baptism as well. You know, there are there were people in Israel who were given the covenant sign, who were not believers, as you pointed out in your summary. But the new covenant is a different type of covenant. Like you said, it's a spiritual covenant. It's internal. It's a heart level covenant. And therefore, I don't think it's appropriate. From what I can see in my understanding of Scripture, I just can't see why you would apply an outward sign of a spiritual reality to someone who has not recognized that spiritual reality in their own life, in a, you know, with what we would call a profession of faith from having actual, you know, I guess, I don't know how to say this. I don't want to say like there's an age of, what do you call it? Age of accountability or whatever. But, you know, we would sort of wait for a solid profession of faith. And then based on that person's profession of faith, we would baptize them, which is quite different to baptizing an infant who can't profess faith. So that would be my response, but I'm keen to hear what you think and whether you've got any different takes.
Yeah, I just have a lot of questions generally in this conversation, but also specifically for Les and Tanner. Like, maybe my number one question is, I really don't understand why the typical trope for Presbyterians is you Baptists raise your kids like we Presbyterians do. Like, do you want me to raise my kid as if he's an atheist? Why would I do that? I don't understand how that somehow proves that I should baptize them. I've never really connected those two dots. I honestly, I would love someone to explain that to me because I don't get it.
Yeah,
I think I think we all agree, generally speaking, that you don't give covenant signs to people who are not in the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And so why would I baptize my babies? Because they're not in the new covenant.
Yeah,
you don't enter into the new covenant distinct from the old covenant by physical descent.
Yeah.
Like one of the things Paul is doing in Galatians 3, I think, is he's saying that the new covenant line is no longer drawn by physical descent.
Yeah.
Children of Abraham are not children of Abraham because they were physically descended from Abraham. No, they're children of Abraham because they're united to, by faith, the one child of Abraham, the one offspring. He even does the weird play on words. It's not offspring. It's not offsprings, it's offspring.
Yeah.
Right? So you become a child of Abraham by spiritual rebirth. That's how the new covenant line is drawn. So when the Spirit of God causes you to be born again and you are united to Christ by faith, that is the moment that God, as I mentioned earlier, transfers you from the domain of darkness into the kingdom of his beloved Son. That's when you become a member of the new covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And then you receive the sign of the new covenant, baptism.
Yeah. Yep. So you're agreeing with what I'm saying, and you're just saying you don't really understand why they would expect us to do it any differently.
Yes, and I would love to understand better.
Yeah, yeah.
I welcome any opportunity to grow in understanding of somebody else's position so that I might not misrepresent it.
Yeah, correct. I'm in the same boat. The only other thing that I think is really strongly tied to what you just said, and I think is maybe helpful mentioning from our perspective or from my perspective, is I actually sat down with my pastor when our son was born and he was a couple months old, and we were wanting to dedicate. And I said to my pastor, because I was going to a Reformed Anglican church, and I said, give me the best case for infant baptism that you've got, because I want to hear it before we make our final decision about what we're doing here. And we probably sat together and talked about it for an hour or hour and a half or something. And he had some good points, but nothing that kind of solidified it for me as, yep, that makes more sense, that, you know, more biblical reason, justification for that than credo baptism. And a lot of that is to do with what we've already talked about. But when I brought up Romans 6 and the fact that it clearly talks about the fact that baptism is a sign of death to sin. You know, the early part of Romans 6 talks about Do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? We were buried, therefore, with him by baptism into death, in order that just as Christ was raised by the from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too might walk in newness of life. What, you know, for a child to be baptized into Christ's death, when what does that mean for that child? Like, how does that really apply to that child? Now, all children are born under total depravity. We believe that, so no child is necessarily perfect, but is perfect. But I just, yeah, it's just another thing that seems inappropriate to me to be sort of doing that on someone else's behalf. Like, dying to self and being raised with Christ is a personal thing. Like, that's something.
It's an action of your own will. I can't do that for you.
That each person does. Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And totally so to have agree. Someone else sort of do that on your behalf and then hope that the effects of it are somehow become fruitful later in life or something just seems unusual.
Yeah, I guess on that point, this is maybe my second question that I just want to ask, and that is, what promise is God making to the children of believers? I really would like somebody to help me understand this. What promise is God making to the children of believers? Mm. And then, what promise is God making to the children of believers who never actually become believers themselves? What promise is made to covenant children who never actually know the Lord, right? I mean, that is not a Jeremiah 31 promise. That is not a everyone from the greatest to the least will know the Lord. That is not a I will remember their iniquities no more. Mm. That's not that kind of promise. Mm. So what promise is it?
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of makes God a bad promise keeper in one sense. Like, I don't know what he's promising. And if he's making new covenant promises, he's not keeping them.
Yeah, because the greatest to the least is talking about all types of people will be included in the new covenant. It's not talking about every single age group, like, you know, infants through to 90-year-olds. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. My point there is the promise that they will know him. So, if we want to talk about Isaac and Ishmael or Jacob and Esau, they were not promised that regardless of who they were, they would know the Lord because they were in a mixed covenant. Jeremiah is not talking about a mixed covenant, as you pointed out earlier.
Yeah.
So what promise is it that God is making to the children of believers?
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't figure it out.
Maybe that they'll be part of the covenant community, but what good is that if at the final analysis they are found to not really be part of the covenant community? Do you know what I mean? Like, I guess that's what you mean by he's a bad promise keeper. Like, it seems like there would be a failure there on someone's part. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question to ask as well.
So anywho, it's another long conversation about baptism, and I'm left with more questions than answers once again.
I don't know if that's true. I think you've got answers. I think you're just wanting to probe all the questions that you can think of to make sure that your answers are still satisfying to you. Is that?
I have a whole list, and I only gave two.
Yeah.
So, this is a longer conversation that we could have sometime, maybe. I don't know. We'll see if any paedo-baptists want to come on and talk about it. I would welcome it. So if you would like to connect with us and talk about technology's effect on love or whether or not you should baptize your babies, you can do so by jumping in our Slack workspace. Sign up at slack.techreformation.com. It is free to join, and you can hang out in there as much as you like.
So let's use episode discussion channel for the technology's not changing love and baptism for baptism.
Sounds good.
Just to state the bleeding obvious.
That's a really good point that you bring up there, Craig. We do have channels in the Slack dedicated to specific topics, and you're not in them, most of them, by default. When you join the Slack, if you just joined recently, you might have joined and seen that you were only in like two channels, like general episode discussion, random tech, theology, something like that. Well, there's like dozens of channels, and they're all dedicated to specific topics. So you've got to go in and join those channels so you'll see where most of the conversation happens. It's not very often that we have a really long running conversation in general, although we did earlier this week, which was great. So we've got hundreds and hundreds of people in there now, and I'm not sure everyone is familiar with Slack as a tool. So if you're not, check out the other channels that you're not in.
Yeah. Also, check out our website at techreformation.com if you want to look through our back catalogue. There's heaps of stuff there. And you can also contact us on Twitter, if that's your thing, at Tech Reformation.
This has been Tech Reformation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. And I ain't looking back.